You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
I don't think there's anybody in Louisiana history who's been the subject of more interest or controversy than Huey Long. Even though he's long ago faded from the scene, he certainly did a lot to affect the state, the state's politics, and even, man, like 30 or 40 years after his death by assassination, he was still affecting the outcome of elections. So he's been a powerful character. And for good or worse, he's also kind of set the image of Louisiana politics. With me today is Alec McManus, who studied Huey Long, who studied his political enemies, of which there were many. He did his dissertation at Tulane on that, and he's doing some ongoing research. I think it's fair to mention, and kind of relevant to this conversation, that when we do this show, we get a lot of different accents, sometimes Cajun, sometimes North Louisiana drawls. Here we have a genuine Northern Ireland accent, which I think is interesting because that leads to my first question. Being a native of Northern Ireland, what interested you about Huey Long?
Well, I came and I did a master's degree in UL Monroe. And when it came to do a thesis, a master's thesis, they had some documents up there about one of Long's friends, supporters, Jimmy Noe, who associated with the TV station up there, KNOE, and also the radio station down here, WNOE.
Right.
All his papers were up there, and it turned out he had a pretty interesting story, and that pulled me into the Huey Long period, and then I got more and more interested once I started looking at Huey Long as something really interesting and significant, not just on the state scene, but nationally.
Yeah. And Noe actually became governor for a while. The Huey Long years after Huey Long left triggered a whole bunch of turnover in the governor's office, and Jimmy Noe was briefly governor. Let's just see for people who may not be totally familiar. Huey Long was elected in 1928. Is that correct? Now,
governor. Yeah.
Yeah. You hear so much about him, you would think he was governor forever. In fact, he didn't even last a full term.
That's right. But he got elected to the Senate in 1930, but he didn't take the office up for a year or two because he didn't trust his lieutenant governor. He waited until his term expired. He got somebody else elected, and then he could essentially, through Oscar Allen, who was the new governor, he was able to control the state as if he were governor. The story is that if a leaf blew in to O.K. Allen's onto O.K. Allen's desk, and he would sign it, thinking that Huey had given him orders to. So he was able to control the state completely through Oscar Allen, and while going to Washington and be senator. So in effect, while he wasn't governor for that long, for the entire 7 years or so until he was killed, Huey ran the state of Louisiana.
O.K. Allen, I think, was the classic political puppet. I mean, he was just totally controlled by. But I tell you what, I remember as a kid going, like, my relatives were from Central Louisiana, and invariably you're crossing bridges, and there were a lot of bridges that had built under the administration of Huey Long, O.K. Allen, during that period of time. So A.K. Allen, for being a puppet, got his name on a lot of bridges.
Okay. Certainly did.
I don't know if any of the O.K. Allen bridges are left now. They've been open. You know, to me, the event that really shaped the 1928 election was a year earlier, the Great Flood of 1927, because the flood caused a lot of economic and social problems. And so Huey Long was able to run as the champion of the poor people and the deprived people. And the flood certainly spilled that out.
Yep, that's right. He was able to use the flood of 27 and It would be true as well that there had been a long buildup of discontent amongst ordinary people in the state for decades. I mean, it was still largely a cotton economy, and the cotton prices just were, you know, year on year, you know, more or less going down. It was harder and harder to make a living, and the people that ruled the state were not alive to the desires and the needs of the ordinary population. So there was a kind of a groundswell of discontent that Huey Long was able to tap in a way that nobody had before, even close.
And wasn't the concept of government, at least in the United States, different, that prior to that period, government, and certainly the people who governed, saw it as something that provided minimal services, the things you need to do, maybe build a road here, provide some kind of safety protection, you know, that sort of thing, but not having a big list of things that can be done. Then along comes Huey Long, who sees government as doing everything, you know, from free lunches in schools to free textbooks. And so with this, you see the beginning of big government.
Yeah, no, the existing politicians before Huey had no notion of the state providing or being involved much in the lives of ordinary people, no vision that they could improve the lives of ordinary people. In that sense, Huey was completely revolutionary. And he just about predates, what he did in Louisiana just about predates the New Deal and FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, which comes about as a result of the Great Depression in 1929. So Huey's slightly ahead of the game. And as it turns out, despite how unpopular he was with the so-called better elements, what he did today would be regarded as pretty tame, because his conception of what government can do has become broadly accepted and is normal now politically.
So is it proper to describe this period as populism?
I think absolutely, in the sense that if populism is defined as being as consisting of more than, you know, the neighborhood eccentric and being in some way genuinely anti-establishment, then Huey Long certainly fits the bill.
Now, Huey was a great showman. Just very entertaining, and he was the only politician who had his own anthem, and that was a song called Every Man a King. And we just want to play a few bars for those who might not have been familiar with it, but this is kind of spreading the message of populism, because under his plan, every man a king, and this is done by Randy Newman. Okay.
Slumber America, land of brave and true. There's castles and clothing and food for all. All belongs to you. Every man a king, every man a king, for you can be a millionaire. If there's something belonging to others, there's enough for all.
So there's something belonging to all of us, but there's enough for all people to share. Every man a king, and you can be a millionaire. And that song got a lot of attention, though. I'm sure you've seen that. You have those old movie reels, the news, where they show Huey Long. I think he was in New York before a group of people, and he's playing. He's kind of dancing along to Every Man a King. And that was the Randy Newman version. And curiously, the Randy Newman version is this album he did, Louisiana, which talks about the Great Flood of 27. And so he tries to connect the two also.
Yes, I think, did Randy Newman do a song with Huey, about something like showing the people from New Orleans what the you know, the backwoods people were all about? Do you remember that number?
I don't remember mine, but that probably sounds right, yeah. That was certainly a theme that he had. you know, at that state, I mean, the state was pretty much divided politically and culturally between the North and the South. And I'm sure you've read stories about Huey Long campaigning in North Louisiana and constantly putting down New Orleans. And one reason is that his main nemesis was Dulles Epps Morrison, who was the mayor of New Orleans. And so anytime you could put down New Orleans, and New Orleans was seen as the ultimate of waste and high living and lavishness. And so it was a good move to put down New Orleans.
Yes, it was Walmsley actually at that point. Morrison's a wee bit later. Mayor Walmsley was in New Orleans.
Right.
But I think the problem for it was like a political problem for Huey. He knew that he could get the backwoods vote, which made him very competitive everywhere in the state. But he found it very difficult to get what you call the working class New Orleans vote, because it was tightly controlled by the old regulars, the New Orleans political machine, which was very organized and which had a long-standing alliance kind of with the planter interests up in the country. And Huey, I think, thought, those people really are my people and they should be voting for me. And Mayor Walmsley and the old regular leadership didn't like Huey. They didn't like the idea of being interfered with by a backwoods politician. So they resisted alliance with Huey, and that meant war. And they were in political war, those two sides, for 3 or 4 years before eventually Huey was able to destroy the old regular machine and get the remnants of it to join him. So it was a tough, tough battle, and he really needed that New Orleans vote to make him comfortable winning statewide elections. Until he could get that vote, it was still quite hard work for him to win, to get his candidates elected statewide. So the battle with New Orleans was pretty real. He was also famously hostile to the sort of uptown New Orleans, well-to-do establishment, who were respectable, who were extremely old-fashioned and didn't, they didn't like his manners. They probably thought that he smelled. Mm-hmm. You know, his backwoods speech was probably deeply offensive to them. They were snobs. And they despised him absolutely till the day that he died. And there was never going to be much of an alliance between those two groups.
There's a famous speech that he made. It was somewhere in North Louisiana where he's putting down New Orleans. And he's saying that the people of New Orleans, they eat at Antoine's. And then he makes fun of the classic dish, Pompano and Pompolette. You know, which is Pompano that's baked in the bag. It's a very classical dish. And he says, they like to go to Antoine's and eat probably pea pot and a poke. Okay. And then he says, now me, Huey, I like a slice of ham at the Piccadilly. And so
he said that. That's good.
The slice of ham versus the poly pea pot in the poke.
He always made a point actually of making sure that people knew that he was a regular person, that he didn't know about the finer things. One time he's quoted as he got a fancy piece of salad at a nice restaurant, and he looked at it and he said, "What is this twig that you're putting before me?" And famously, he also went to the when he first got elected and went to the Senate and went up north, he went to the Waldorf hotel. And he said, look, he ordered a Waldorf sandwich, and he said, look, you haven't made this correctly. You've got the wrong, you've made this wrong, which takes some nerve to tell the Waldorf that they've that they've messed up their own recipe. But he did delight, I think, in displaying his backwoods manners. And he even more delighted, I think, was the reaction that he would get from the people who considered themselves socially better than him, because he knew it really played with ordinary voters. So he was quite clever. The social elite would make fun of him, poke fun at him, and they thought they were damaging him politically, but in fact they were really damaging themselves, because they were showing themselves to be elitists and snobs, and the ordinary people just cheered on Huey even more. So he was quite smart, I think, in using ordinary language, and using the vernacular of the people, and not dressing up his talk and trying to impress with big intimidating words that country people didn't feel comfortable with.
Now, at the same time, you talk about going to the Waldorf in New York, but he had his hotel in New Orleans with the Roosevelt Hotel, which was like his favorite hangout by far. And the guy who managed it, Seymour Weiss, I think was the treasurer of his organization. And so he was, and to this day, I know there was a story about the D-Duck box, in that supposedly Huey had this box and state employees were asked to make a contribution to his campaign. It was deducted from their salary. And to this day, there's rumors that the duck box is hidden somewhere in the Roosevelt Hotel. Now, since then, the hotel is going through a massive uplift, facelifting after Katrina, and nobody found it. But that was a really popular spot.
Yep, that's where he made his base in New Orleans. And he was very close to Seymour Weiss. Seymour Weiss was his closest confidant, very loyal to him. And I think did keep some of the money that Long raised from state employees, which is how Long funded his machine, was by taking deductions from employees of the state, usually only the higher ups, but everybody during election times. And that's how we funded the machine. I think the deduct box is an interesting story. And I'm hopeful myself that maybe I'll find it someday, but I think it might be more of a, I think that there were all sorts of people and places where the money was kept. I'm not sure if it was all kept in one central deduct box that somebody made off with the day Huey Long died. I imagine it was more distributed than that. But I've no doubt that a few people made off with some money after Long died. Usually people mention Seymour Weiss, and sometimes they mention Earl Long as well.
Well, I want to talk about the assassination in a few minutes, but supposedly when he was lying in the hospital dying, and he said something like, if my people ever use the powers I've left them without me to check on them, they're going to all wind up in jail. So he knew that there was power out there, and in fact, some did wind up in jail.
Many of them did. In fact, it was Richard Lesh became governor after Huey, in fact, Jimmy Ngo thought it should have been him, and it was Jimmy Ngo that was responsible for bringing the corruption of the machine after Long's death to public light. He hired investigators. There was so much money sloshing around by that stage, and a lot of the higher ups were taking money. And Jimmy Ngo was furious that he hadn't been chosen as the Long candidate for governor in 36. And he obviously was a bitter man who knew how to hold a grudge, and was wealthy, so he kept tabs on a lot of the higher ups and fed this to the newspapers and to the FBI, and eventually the whole Long machine came crashing down under the weight of these so-called scandals. They were called the Louisiana scandals. By about 1939, Lesh had to resign. And Earl Long, I think, briefly became governor. And that sort of set Earl up then as the real successor to Huey.
And so Richard Lesh, who was the Long candidate, was from the New Orleans area. I think he lived on the North Shore or something. But anyway, so he's from the New Orleans area. So maybe that was an attempt to kind of try to get a New Orleans candidate. And he's the one that went to jail.
He did indeed, yeah. Several people went to jail, and some people committed suicide. I remember one chap committed suicide, and he left a note saying, "Never explain. Your enemies won't believe you, and your friends don't require it." But it was quite a painful episode for a lot of people, and many of them went to jail. And there was a tremendous amount of corruption in the machine. Although Huey himself, I don't think, was in it for the money. I was not that interested in money. He was interested in power.
Sure.
But plenty of the lower downs were making good money out of the Long machine.
Now, a major factor in all this, I mean, his ability to get legislation passed to have free education and free textbooks and free lunches and really make Louisiana a welfare state, the money had to come from somewhere. And this would have been the oil industry. I mean, wasn't the oil industry emerging? And so part of the battle is really about where the oil money goes.
That's absolutely right. Standard Oil had a huge refinery. It may have been the biggest in the country at the time in Baton Rouge. It's still there. And they were not paying any tax at all on the refining of oil. And Huey tried to pass a modest tax on it in 1929, and he was impeached. Such was the reaction. And Standard Oil bought a lot of those votes in the state legislature to get him impeached. But he eventually was able to get some tax on the oil industry, some on the lumber, some on gas, and it funded an awful lot of his program. And we would consider those taxes today pretty modest, but at the time it was revolutionary, and it shifted the burden of taxation from especially those sort of non-plantation farmers, yeoman types, who were having to pay property taxes and so on. He shifted the burden of taxation from them onto a lot of these extractive industries, and it raised the overall tax intake, and it did allow him to do a lot of things: the free school books, the infrastructure program, an expansion and building of healthcare and building of hospitals, very successful night school program. Louisiana was had the highest illiteracy rate in the nation when Huey Long got into office, and he was tremendously successful in getting people, and including adults, to learn how to read and write. And he was able to do it by, as you say, taxing those extractive industries that had simply not been paying anything. So it was, even though it was opposed incredibly, he was very successful in doing it.
Okay, we have another brief clip that I want to play. This is Huey making a speech. I think this is in New York too, of his trying to explain, this is just a partial part of it, his share of wealth program. So Huey Long.
According to the tables which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with.
Yeah. The way he delivers that last line, you know, make that man come back and give some of the grub he has no business with.
He was a magnificent speaker. He was absolutely brilliant at talking to a crowd. Superb.
You know, just a lot of humor, because anytime you see these things, you can hear the audience chuckling in the background with it. What did the other states, like Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas, what did they think when they saw what was going on in Louisiana? Was there a similar movement?
There was considerable interest, particularly when he went national and started announced his Share the Wealth program. There was a lot of Share the Wealth clubs set up in neighboring states, a lot of interest in Mississippi. And nationally as well, Franklin Roosevelt was pretty worried about Huey Long, and he did adopt some of the Long program. So he was able to fold a little bit of Huey's policies into the New Deal. So people were fairly satisfied with Roosevelt, although they certainly liked Huey as well.
So Social Security would have come out of the New Deal. Do you think that would have been a Huey Long influence on Franklin Roosevelt?
I don't know if Social Security would be. I think, yeah, to some degree, there was an income tax Roosevelt put on people with very large incomes. That was definitely a response to Huey Long and Share the Wealth. But look, Roosevelt was his own man. He was determined to make progress himself. Roosevelt, I think, and the New Deal are similar to Huey's program, but, onto themselves to some degree.
This is what some people refer to as Roosevelt's turn to the left.
Right, yes, that's right, yes. And he said that he was going to steal Long's thunder. He did. He was very worried about Huey Long. I think the prospect of having to really go head-to-head with Huey, fighting for votes, the way that Huey could connect to ordinary people, as smart as Huey was, I suspect it was frightening even for someone as capable as Franklin Roosevelt.
Right. Another symbolic gesture, of which there were many, that Huey took in was LSU. He pretty much adopted LSU and became like a leader. And there's these famous scenes of LSU's playing Vanderbilt in Nashville, and he has a parade. He brings the whole student body to Nashville, and he really becomes part of the scene there.
He does. He was brilliant at realizing that people liked the idea of having a state university, that they wanted to give some sort of emotional connection with their state university, that they wanted to associate with the football team, with the pomp and glamour of the band, and that it was a harmless enough way. This is the 30s, after all, where you have fascism in Europe and so on, that it was a harmless enough way to get people emotionally excited, in the same way that people still are today, you know, with SEC football and so on. I think he was ahead of his time in realizing just how much people enjoyed that and how much it kind of rolled into his overall popularity.
I wanted to mention that when we played Every Man a King a few minutes ago, that the song was written, well, I think Huey helped with the lyrics, but the actual music was written by a guy named Castro Carozo. And he had been the Blue Room director, or the director of the band at the Blue Room in the Roosevelt Hotel. And Huey brought him to LSU. And like, to Huey's idea, I mean, probably the only band director he knew in the world was the band director at the Blue Room, all right? And so that's the guy he brought. And so this guy goes from a nightclub band director to a school director, and all of a sudden he's writing fight songs and those sort of things.
I was lucky enough to interview, it was Jimmy Noe's daughter, or was it? I interviewed Jimmy Noe's daughter and his son. One of them said that it was Seymour Weiss, of course, ran the Roosevelt Hotel and operated the Blue Room. And they said that he absolutely insisted that the Blue Room, the shows in the Blue Room, be respectable. He didn't want any smut. He didn't want anything that wasn't classy. He absolutely insisted that the Blue Room shows be a class act all the way through.
You know, there were a lot of highways that were built during that time. And the legend is, I don't know if it's true or not, but the state capitol is the building we now call the old state capitol. So that's where Huey was operating out of. And that Huey insisted that the highway that we refer to in New Orleans as the Airline Highway, I'm not sure what the number is, it might be 66 or something, okay? But that highway was being built and that it connect the state capitol to Roosevelt Hotel. That'd be more or less a straight line between the two. And if you look at it on the map, it sort of is. It kind of goes, right into New Orleans and like toward the back area where the Roosevelt had been. So that was like his private highway from the capitol to the Roosevelt Hotel.
It's amazing. You think that Huey, on the day that he died, he was in, or that he was shot, I should say, he was in at the Roosevelt that morning. He was speaking to Seymour Weiss. I think they went and played golf, or that might have been the day before, at Audubon Park. Then he took Airline Highway up to Baton Rouge, which Airline Highway was something that he had got built. Then he went to the Capitol, which he had built. I mean, this was a man that had that made and owned his environment in a way that few of us ever do.
Absolutely, yeah. I doubt if any of us listening will, in the course of our lifetime, build a state capitol, you know? So it was a pretty impressive state capitol. I mean, what we now call the new state capitol. I mean, that was a building unlike anything else. I want to talk about that too, and maybe about that day you referred to. First, let me mention, we're talking to Alex McManus, who is a historian. He's done a lot of research on Huey Long, doing his dissertation. And he has some long-range book projects also involved in that. you referred to that day. What was it, 1935?
Yeah.
Okay, so he started off in New Orleans, and then he goes to Baton Rouge. And now he went to the new state capitol. Was it completed yet, or were people working in there now? Or
Absolutely. It was up and running.
Okay. And so he went, this is on the Sunday, okay. But he was a senator, but yet he's able to kind of convene whoever he wants to go to the state capitol. So take it from there, like Huey arriving at the state capitol that Sunday afternoon.
Yep, he went up because he had called a special session of the state legislature in order to pass more legislation that would concentrate powers in the state, in the office of the governor. What he was doing at the time...
Just keep this in mind, this is the United States Senator calling a special session.
That's right.
Legislature, okay?
That's right.
It's he has no power to do. But of course, he did it through OKL. But anyway, go ahead.
That's right. So he was going to get legislation passed to concentrate more power in the office of the governor. He was removing power from the local level. What he really wanted to do, Huey Long understood the power of patronage, and he wanted to be able to control local patronage, for example, New Orleans patronage, so that if you got hired in a school in New Orleans as a janitor, that had to be okayed by Huey Long. And that gives him incredible power to get votes. So that's what he was doing. He was going to get more legislation passed that put more power in the office of the governor. He went up, he directed the session of the legislature. He was walking ahead of his bodyguards out of the state capitol, and some sort of confrontation occurred with a doctor called Carl Weiss, no relation to Seymour Weiss. And in all likelihood, Carl Weiss shot him, and Long rushed on out of the building, wounded, ahead of his bodyguards, who killed Carl Weiss, and was taken to the hospital. And there was some unsuccessful attempts made to get the bullet out and to stop the bleeding. It was a wound in the belly area, the abdomen, but that was unsuccessful, and he died 2 or 3 days later. Carl Weiss was from an anti-Long background, very respectable background, a doctor, apparently a very moral and honest man. And his three of his relatives, including a judge, Judge Pavey up in St. Landry Parish, had been removed from positions by Long, to taking away, you know, really removing, Long was removing patronage positions from people who did not support him. And Weiss thought that Long had gone way, way too far, that he was far too powerful, that he was a dictator, that he was destroying constitutional government. And I think, being the sort of man that he was, Carl Weiss, he at some point he flipped and decided to take action himself.
Yeah. And of course, Long was surrounded by his bodyguards, so Weiss would have never, ever had a chance.
No.
I'm trying to think of a story. He had a certain color suit on. Weiss did. Was it the white suit, or whatever it was? Okay. The early reports went out that Long was shot by a man with a white suit, and there were so many people that hated him in New Orleans. And one of them was Hiding Carter, the respected journalist, and his wife, I think it was Betty Carter. When she heard that, she was really shocked. So she ran to her husband's closet, where she knew he had two white suits, okay? You know, fearing that there'd be a white suit missing. And she was so relieved to see that both of the white suits were there. But there was a lot of apprehension, a lot of people wondering if somebody they knew was the assailant that day.
A lot of people on the anti-Long side, a lot of wives wondered, if it had been their husband, and made it a point of finding out where their husband was,
yeah.
Because they'd been talking about killing Huey Long for quite some time. Every time two anti-Longs got together, they said that so-and-so ought to be killed. So it had been in the air for quite a long time. The atmosphere was really tense. There was a real feeling that there was that bloodshed was going to happen. It would be hard to, I think, to put into words just how heightened emotions were just before Long's death. In fact, another anti-Long, Cecil Morgan, his wife said, quick, when they heard about Long's shooting, they said, quick, pull the curtains or and draw down the blinds, because there's going to be something like an anti-Long pogrom because of this. So a lot of people were frightened after Long's death because emotions were really running high.
And then from there, and this is a totally different story, maybe for another time, we see the emergence of Huey's little brother.
Earl. Yeah, and I think Earl in many ways quite similar to Huey, I think burdened by some of the same psychological pressures and a similar program, expanded the Long program in many ways, was able to fold in quite a lot of civil rights progress, which hadn't really occurred under the Huey Long period. And I think Earl is a consistent extension of the Huey Long period and a serious and important politician in his own right.
Okay, now this was long before the Voting Rights Act, so there wasn't much of a black vote back then, but what there was, did Huey get most of that vote?
Yeah, and Earl got all of it. And in actual fact, before the Voting Rights Act, Earl had got tens of thousands of blacks registered to vote, and they all voted for him.
Now in the city, though, at least in New Orleans, Morrison supposedly had a lot of the ministers behind him. And so a lot of the ministers were supposedly able to want to vote for Morrison. So I'm not quite sure what happened when it was between Morrison and Huey Long. But
Morrison was a racial moderate as well. I mean, I would think of Morrison more as linking up with the Earl Long period, not so much with Huey.
Yeah. Well, back then, separate but equal was considered liberal, right? Things would change in the years ahead. At one point, also that Huey, when he was a senator, he wrote a book called My First Days in the White House. So he was actually thinking about it and his plans. And I did look through the book one time, and one thing I noticed is that the first couple of chapters were rather lengthy, and he kind of mentions who he's going to point to what position. And then as you go in there, the chapters get really short, and it looks like he kind of got bored with it, okay? he started his project, and said, hey, I wasn't going to finish this thing. And so he kind of just hurried his way through the rest of it.
Yeah, somebody described it as a scratchy, smug little tale tossed off in a couple of days.
Yeah. So looking back at him, what do you think of him? Well, first of all, his impact on Louisiana, because in the years to follow, if somebody was describing Louisiana politics, you wouldn't call it Republicans versus Democrats. You call it Longs versus anti-Longs, especially at the state level. I mean, that's the people would line up, and most gubernatorial elections were held in that way. And quite often it was, okay, you had the Long candidate, the anti-Long candidate, there'd be a runoff. And a lot of times New Orleans would be the swing vote. And that lasted a long time. That lasted until probably the 1960s. I think maybe the John McKinton election was the first one that got away from that. But it certainly shaped the state's politics.
Absolutely it did. And the modern Democratic Party in Louisiana, I think, is still to some degree shaped by the Long period. But it's no longer the dominant division in state politics. But certainly with Huey, then with Earl, and you see it reappearing, this kind of Long theme in state politics, even up through the 80s and the 90s with Edwin Edwards. Edwin Edwards is straight out of the Long school. So it reappears, but it becomes less important as time goes on. I think the civil rights period damaged Longism because civil rights became such a big issue that it almost, I think it became maybe more important than the long, you know, philosophy of aid, of you know, of you know, expansive government. People became more interested in civil rights, and they tended to maybe vote along that issue. I think if you think about the backwoods voter, who were the core of Long's support, a lot of them probably drifted to different groups during the civil rights period. But I mean, it certainly, look, the Long, Huey Long shaped state politics in Louisiana for decades, absolutely. And just in terms of a legacy, in terms of what he built, he was a builder. The amount of structures and, you know, road, bridges, buildings that he built is incredible.
The charity hospital system, the
right
free healthcare, that was like really revolutionary.
Absolutely.
And then building your own state hospital. Yeah.
And look, it all, somebody like Hodding Carter, you know, the anti-Long, very respected journalist, would say, yes, he did those things, but it all came with a kind of whiff of corruption, that there was something sort of dark and unpleasant about it, that everything costed more than it should because so many people were getting paid off, because the payrolls were being padded. So there's a kind of, some sort of trade-off involved here. But I think most people, certainly in the state of Louisiana, were happy to take Long's side of the trade. And Earl Long himself said one time, at some point, the people of Louisiana are going to get good government and they aren't going to like it. Honest government, and they aren't going to like it.
Yeah.
In fact, Earl Liebling wrote a great book about the Longs. And A.J. Liebling, sorry, A.J. Liebling.
Yeah.
He wrote a great book, and he was interviewing a New Orleans politician, and the politician said the Longs were like people that a guy that comes along in a game of pool, and he breaks the balls and he runs a few, and then he misses one, but then the balls are broken up and everybody else can come along and have a shot. He said, with the Longs, everybody has a shot at it. He says, before everything was tight, the ordinary people didn't get a shot. And I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. The Longs broke the balls open.
You know, what you said reminds me of an Earl Long quote where he said, people who are with me in the first primary get jobs. People who are with me in the second primary get good government.
I like that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Let me do one more. Okay. Again, Earl Long, supposedly talking to a senator, and he wasn't quite sure where the senator was politically. And he said, Senator, I need to ask you, are you for me or are you against me? And the senator very self-righteously says, Governor, when you're right, I'm with you. When you're wrong, I'm against you. And Earl Long says, when I'm right, I don't need you.
That's an interesting point because it speaks to loyalty. The Longs did demand loyalty, and they did want loyalty. Yeah. And loyalty, meaning that, you know, whenever they got it wrong, you still had to be loyal to them. Even if you didn't agree with everything they did, and if you were loyal, you would be rewarded. If you were only with them whenever it suited you, you couldn't expect the same kind of bounty and welcome from the Longs. Loyalty is an important part of running a political machine.
Now, we should just mention that Huey's son eventually became senator, served a long time in the Senate, had a very distinguished career as a senator, became the chairman of the Finance Committee, and was really one of the most powerful people in Washington. And as far as I know, there was never any corruption or anything associated with him.
Would you say that, do you think that Russell was in the same mold, just in terms of his personality, as Huey and Earl, or do you think he was a different kind of man?
Oh yeah, he was different. Yeah,
yeah.
Those days of that kind of personality were over, and he really became a mainstream Washington politician, but one who was very successful. Before we go, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a little bit about Northern Ireland. Have you been there lately, and how are things there? Are things fairly peaceful now, or?
Things have been very, very, very good since about the mid-90s. But there are occasional flare-ups, and they seem to be experiencing one at the moment because I think of Brexit, which has kind of upset some parts of the political status quo there. And, in Northern Ireland, even when it's peaceful, you never seem to be that far away from some sort of flare-up. So there's a bit of rioting going on at the moment, some discontent, and I guess everybody has their fingers crossed that it passes. Usually it passes. Sometimes it gets worse. I hope it doesn't.
But the issue isn't Catholic, non-Catholic anymore. I mean, is it political factions now, or?
The issue is still the same, and it is the Protestant population identify as being British and want to remain part of the United Kingdom, and the Catholic population identify as Irish and want to unify Northern Ireland with the Republic of Ireland. So the issue is exactly the same. Basically, the two forms of fairly extreme nationalism fighting over the same small patch of land, and they've spilt a lot of blood. There's a lot of long memories. There's a lot of bitterness. And every time there is a breakout of trouble, it sort of refreshes those memories and that bitterness, and creates, adds to the kind of half-life of the problem. But it's a fairly intractable problem. But look, that's not to say that things haven't been very good over the last couple of decades. And I think most, by far and away, the majority of people want to see these problems resolved through peaceful political constitutional methods.
On a routine day, could people in Northern Ireland go into Ireland peacefully?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Right. And so it's every so often it flares up.
It flares up every so often, but the relations are really pretty good. I wouldn't want to overstress the tension just on a day-to-day level. One thing we could have said something about was Robert Penn Warren's book, Man.
Oh, yeah. Well, go ahead.
I forgot about that. Yeah, but Robert Penn Warren wrote this tremendous novel, All the King's Men, which is really based very, very closely on the life of Huey Long. It's considered the best, I think, political novel in American history. And it's a really deep exploration of whether the ends justify the means. And Huey was considered to be a little bit loose when it came to the means, that he was transgressive when it came to means, but that was what the question, and I think Warren thinks that would agree with this, is that was there any other way to push through that kind of change in Louisiana without being fairly rough with the political system, without using patronage ruthlessly, this idea that you can always achieve what's needed, what you're trying to achieve, without simply by going by the book. That idea is questionable, especially in a state like Louisiana, which had a pretty rough political tradition. The people who came before Huey Long were not wallflowers. It was not a warm and cuddly state politically prior to Long's election. So he was building on a long tradition of people using, let's say, rough methods to achieve their political ends. And that, maybe there's a comparison with Northern Ireland there.
And actually, by the time Huey Long was born, I mean, there were still remnants of the Civil War. I mean, there were still people living who had been involved in the Civil War. So they'd gone for that period of turmoil.
But that's absolutely right. And through that whole period of unrest that followed the Civil War and lasts up until the 1890s, a lot of people, their politics were defined by that period. And that had been a period with an awful lot of violence, much, much more than anything that occurred during the Huey Long period. And a lot of Long's enemies were very quick to start speaking about violence and saying that they were prepared to resort to violence to get Huey Long stopped. And they compared him, they continually compared Long to the carpetbaggers and the scalawags of the Reconstruction era. They seemed to think he was the same sort of threat as the as those people had been back after the Civil War.
You know, there's a lot of conflicts in world history that you can link to a group of people that felt like they're the insiders and feeling threatened by another faction. And you see that in different variations and different people over and over throughout history.
Yeah. Huey Long was the champion of the outsiders, and he really gave those insiders hell, and they absolutely hated him for it.
Yeah. I wanted to mention, when you talked about Edwin Edwards sort of like being a Huey Long politician, you know, Edwin Edwards was born in 1927, which was the year of the flood. All right. And it was also been the year when Huey Long was campaigning for governor, which he was elected in 28, became governor. So Edwin Edwards, I mean, from the time he was a baby, okay, with in that environment, in all of his childhood when he was growing up, it was in the whole environment of Longism. And so, yeah, it was all around him. And he grew up in central Louisiana and part of the country that was most severely affected by the flood. Yeah.
Right. And I think Edwin Edwards must have been an admirer of the Longs, and he's clearly in some way is identifiably from the Long tradition. There was a Cajun populist around the time of Huey Long called Dudley LeBlanc, Cousin yeah. Dudley LeBlanc. And I think he might have been the most significant Acadian politician before, in the populist style, before Edwin Edwards. Would that be right?
Yeah, he made this, in addition to being a politician, he had this this cure-all medicine he had called Hattacall.
Yeah.
And Hattacall could do anything, make a cure. Dandruff, athlete's feet, okay, cancer, anything. Just take a swig of Hattacall. And finally, after a few years, the FDA analyzed it and said, look, this is just alcohol with a little food color in it or something. And they made him stop. But he made a career. And he used to have these tours around the state where he'd get a lot of entertainers. And they had like these road shows, Hattacall road shows. And people would go and they'd watch the show and they'd sell Hattacall. So, yeah, he certainly contributed to that colorful politician role. I think he ran for governor, but didn't do too well. But anyway.
Oh, he did indeed. He ran in 32 against Oscar Allen. And he claimed that he'd won the election by the biggest majority in the history of the state, and that the vote was stolen from him. I think he was probably being over generous to himself, but there was some voter fraud in that election, because in St. Bernard Parish, the results in St. Bernard Parish showed every single vote for Oscar Allen and not one single vote for Dudley LeBlanc. And Dudley LeBlanc was entitled to wonder aloud, as he did, why his own brother, who lived in St. Bernard, didn't vote for him.
Yeah. I think it was another story that maybe apocryphal, I don't know, but that LeBlanc's mother's side was a Baudouin, that side of the family. And for some reason, he was in Europe. And at the time, the king of Belgium was King Baudouin. And so he went and made an appointment to meet King Baudouin, arguing that he's, you know, a senator from Louisiana, Baudouin, like the, you know, the meeting of the powerful Baudouins. I'm sure the king didn't have much use for him, but anyway. Well, this has been delightful. It's a fun thing to talk about. Good luck in your pursuits with your other things. You know? So certainly fascinating area of study.
Thank you very much.
Let's try this again some other time. Thank you very much, John McManus. And when that book comes out, let us know. We'll do a follow-up, okay?
Thank you very much, Errol.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.